I'm Jennifer Roback, Associate Professor of Economics at George Mason University and Research Associate here at the Center for Study of Public Choice. I've been engaged in research project for the last 5 years or so, concentrating on the economics of discrimination and segregation. The reason I chose this particular research project is that I believe that understanding the problems of discrimination and segregation is absolutely crucial for advocates of the free society. Free market advocates often get themselves into a lot of trouble on the question of segregation and discrimination because, on the one hand, we argue that people should be free to associate with whomever they want. At the same time, because we believe in freedom and individual liberty, we're very concerned about the fact that people find themselves in dire straits or deprived of things simply because of their race or group association. And so what I've been doing has been to study the economics of discrimination and to try to understand what it is that the market can contribute to freedom and genuine liberation for minority groups versus what the role of the state might be. And that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years, and I'm going to talk with you about that for the next hour.
Jennifer, I think the subject matter of your work is an example of the fact that economists seem to be ever expanding the range of activity that they subject to analysis. Is there any collection of knowledge that does not involve what we call economic principles?
Well, Bob, I'm not sure what you're driving at with that question, but as far as the social world is concerned, I can't think of many important exceptions. Some of my colleagues do stuff in biology and so forth, and I don't know very much about that myself. There seems to be some relationship between behavior under constraints and so forth that is quite similar to what goes on in economics, even in the biological world. But for myself, I'm mostly interested in the social world, and then of course everything does seem to have to do with economics. But at the same time, everything seems to have to do with history and politics and sociology as well. And so in a project of the kind that I've been involved in, it's really been necessary for me to get involved in other kinds of disciplines simply to do the question or to study the question in a appropriate and meaningful way.
Is it a mistake for us to try to make hard distinctions between economics and political science?
Well, I think, yes, I don't see much point in making those distinctions. Let's put it that way. For example, here at the university, we have programs where we invite students to come and participate and learn something about public choice. Well, those students will come from philosophy and economics and political science and history, and they all get a great deal out of the program and they all contribute to it. At the same time, here on the faculty, we have colleagues who are interested in philosophy, a colleague who's a sociologist, and all these various disciplines can all bring something, I think, quite interesting to bear on the set of questions that we work on here at the Public Choice Center, simply because what we're worried about is the interaction between the individual and the state. And so as soon as you start worrying about the individual and the state, you're necessarily concerned with things other than pure economics.
Well, what's a good layman's definition of economics? How can I understand
that? Well, Bob, what we always tell the freshmen is that economics is the science of choice under constraint, or it's the science of scarcity. So if you didn't have scarce resources, you wouldn't need the study of economics. You're trying to allocate scarce resources among competing wants. And the most important of the scarce resources that we face is the fact that our time is limited. We're all going to die someday. So each of us has a scarce resource of time to contend with, even if we were millionaire. And the science of economics is designed to explain and study how it is that people make those choices among competing alternatives.
That means choices like whether I buy a hamburger or go to the movie?
Of course. I mean, and Bob, those are the kinds of things that we always worried about first. I mean, when the science of economics was in its infancy, that's the kind of choice we worried about, was hamburgers, pizzas, you know, various things that are obviously considered consumer goods. But now, what I think is the most interesting thing happening more recently in economics is that people are starting to take that same apparatus and apply it to all kinds of other things. So Gary Becker, for instance, has applied it to the economics of the family, the choice of how many children to have or whether to get married or when to get married, those kind of things. Here at the Public Choice Center, we're worried about political choices or public choices rather than the simple private consumption choices of the kind that you just mentioned.
At what point in your life did you think consciously of becoming an economist?
Well, I think I wanted to become an economist when I was an undergraduate at Ohio State University. The professors that I had at Ohio State University were mostly recent graduates from the University of Chicago. And when they arrived there, they were very excited about free market kinds of ideas and the Chicago School approach to things. And after I had taken maybe one or two courses, actually, with those fellows, I realized that this is what I wanted to do, that I wanted to become an economist, and I wanted to be an economist of this type. And the reason that was so appealing to me was that, well, I had taken a few economics courses before. I had a course in Keynesian economics and a course in Marxist economics, and it just didn't do much for me. It didn't excite me. It didn't mean anything to me. But learning free market economics from the Chicago School fellows, what it showed me was, first of all, a powerful set of tools that could help you to analyze and understand the world. And that's basic Chicago-style price theory, and I still think it's true that nobody does that any better than Chicago does. But at the same time, the other thing that was appealing about it was the idea that what was important was to give people what they wanted, and that meant a great value upon freedom, on individual freedom. So that what I heard those guys saying to me was, look, the purpose of the economy is to satisfy consumers. It's not to meet some grand plan of some guru. The purpose is to give consumers what they want. And that was the approach that I was taught. Now, as it turns out, I think that here at the Public Choice Center, we're pursuing that kind of idea more thoroughly than almost anyone else that I know of, because we're now concerned about, first of all, can we create political and economic systems that give people what they want? And secondly, how successful are different kinds of political institutions at giving people what they want? And are there certain kinds of wants that you're just never going to be able to satisfy, or that it's not appropriate to try to satisfy? And of course, that's where we start to get into the other disciplines, where we're no longer simply dealing with the economics that compares apples and oranges and tries to decide how much of each the consumer will buy. Now we're looking at choices which are much more difficult.
You have degrees from what colleges?
Well, my undergraduate degree is from Ohio State University. And my graduate degree, I got my doctorate from the University of Rochester in 1980. And I spent a year as a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Chicago.
Well, you were in college, if I'm correct, just following the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that was a time when black activism was high. What was your first personal experience with the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, Bob, I can't say that I had much in the way of personal experiences with the Civil Rights Movement. I think I'm a little younger than you think I am. When I was in school, I distinctly remember the fall of Saigon when I was in college. But my experience was not so much with Civil Rights Movement, per se, as it was with individual black people and black families that I knew. When I was a student at Oberlin College, for example, I studied there for 2 years before I went to Ohio State. My best friends there were blacks, and that has been true at a number of other universities where I've been associated. When I was on the faculty at Yale University, my best friend there was black. And so I would say more than becoming interested in discrimination because of the civil rights movement, it's been more that I've been interested in it because of black people that I knew and cared about.
Well, there has been some debate as to whether the effort to end de jure segregation by government, was appropriately called a civil rights movement. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I guess I don't know the context of your question. What do you mean it shouldn't have been called a civil rights movement? What should it have been called, for example?
Well, I'm not sure. What I have in mind is the sense in which it seems as if once started, there has been no end to what it is that we claim our rights.
Well, I think I understand what you're asking me. I think that the early civil rights movement would have best been just described as a human rights movement, Because what is not commonly understood is the extent to which the modern civil rights movement really had to undo the results of past laws. So, and we've gotten ourselves into a very kind of difficult situation in this in our lifetime, because we see the law and the government as a means for bringing about all kinds of remedies to make people better off and end discrimination and so forth. But what we don't realize is that when the civil rights movement got started in the 50s and 60s, what it was largely doing was correcting the results of past laws, not just the results of people saying, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have any blacks around? Why don't we all decide to discriminate? No, that's not what was going on. What by and large was going on, or certainly a large element of what was going on, was that people were saying, we don't like blacks. They're making out okay. They're making money. They're buying property. They're going to school and so forth. We don't want them around. Why don't we pass a law to get rid of them, or to segregate them, or to put them someplace where they'll be out of our way, or where we won't have to compete with them? And people, I think, do not fully appreciate just how true that was, just how much a part of black legal disabilities or black social disabilities have come from law rather than through kind of private actions of individuals. Now, of course, the difficult part is that after you had, you know, two generations of legal disability, you, along with that, now have a whole lot of cultural baggage that goes with it. And that is harder to get rid of and more difficult to deal with. But on the other hand, the question is, to what extent do you want to use your legal system as a means of doing that type of stuff?
Well, the civil rights movement involved some individuals who I think it would be fair to describe as socialists.
Oh, yes, and, yes, yes,
and,
yes.
And they argue that discrimination against blacks following the Civil War, for example, was a classic example of the failure of the marketplace, of the free market. Does your research support that view?
Well, you see, that's exactly the view that I think is very important to counteract. You're certainly correct that a lot of people who were and are involved in the civil rights movement are, to one degree or another, socialists, or in various ways hostile to the market order, and hostile to what one might describe as an individualist approach to human freedom. They're more interested in group freedom, or they're more interested in different kinds of things. There's no question about that. But to answer your question, the reason that I have been engaged in so much research on the history of discrimination and segregation is precisely to answer the question that you just raised. And I think that what the evidence shows is that there was a great deal of discrimination that was not successful in the private market. Let's put it that way. That is, immediately after the Civil War, there was a severe labor shortage throughout the South. As you might imagine, when a lot of people are dead, it's a lot harder to get your agricultural sector moving properly. So in a situation where a lot of people had died, a lot of your labor force, prime age labor force, had died because of the war, and then the slave population was now emancipated. That put the slave population, the former slave population, to a very strong bargaining position. And they were able to, in many cases, negotiate for fairly successfully for better wages and so on and so forth. And, well, there are a great many things which went on in the period immediately after the Civil War, of course. It's I think, dangerous to generalize from that immediate period. But moving through the 19th century, later in the 19th century, you do see extensive competition for black farm labor. You see black farm workers being able to negotiate contracts. You see them acquiring property. You see them moving from the ranks of wage earners up to sharecroppers, up to renters, up to finally owning their own property. And that was the hierarchy in their mind. And what you find is that at the end of the 19th century, you find a lot of legal disabilities being imposed upon blacks. And that happened largely because of politics, not so much because of markets. The fact is that blacks were becoming fairly successful competitors in the agricultural sector.
So you're saying that government imposed discrimination occurred because racism was unable to dominate the marketplace.
Well,
or have an outlet in it.
Well, I think a way to put it is this. Suppose you're a group of people that would like to discriminate against blacks. Well, if you're only going to discriminate against them by yourselves, then you have a few neighbors who are not so interested in discriminating against them. Well, the black workers can go and work for those other people. And that's part of what happened. And what happened was there would often be cartels or attempted cartels where people would say, well, we've got to hold down black wages. We just have to hold down black wages. This is really disgraceful how much these guys are earning and so forth. We can't allow this. Well, those cartels were hardly ever successful. I think I can say never successful in that black workers could just go someplace else and get a job. And if your crop was the crop that was rotting in the field, you were not going to be all that worried about how much you paid, or at least your preference for discrimination was going to kind of go by the wayside in the face of your economic interest. And so therefore, if you wanted to extract higher wages from blacks, you had to do something else. It just wasn't going to work doing it simply through this kind of privately organized cartel. These cartels were too unstable for that to work.
Well, how was this unwillingness of individuals to allow racism to, if you would, cost them money in the marketplace? How was that unwillingness there changed to willingness to have the discrimination occur through political means?
Well,
still costs involved, I assume.
Well, one of the things that you can do by moving from a market solution to a political solution is you can shift costs onto somebody else. And of course, not every form of discrimination that people might want to undertake would necessarily emerge in the political arena, okay? Because you need to be able to either shift the costs onto somebody else, or you need to somehow control entry or limit mobility or something of that kind in order to actually create some rents in the system. But by that I mean in order to create some kind of wedge between supply and demand so that people can extract more from the market than they would have been able to extract from the market had the whole system been unrestrained. Okay, so if you have a cartel type situation, the classic cartel situation is that you have to limit entry, because if you can't limit entry, then people will bid down wages and so forth, and that sort of thing. So one of the things which went on in the Southern situation in the Southern labor market, it was not so much that they had an honest to goodness organized cartel, because even using politics, that the agricultural market is so competitive, you know, and there are so many participants, it would really be difficult to do something of that kind. What they did instead was, in the late 19th century, they had a series of laws which made it easier for employers and planters to extract what they wanted from their black help. And it made it more difficult for blacks to change jobs, for example. It didn't make it impossible, but it made it more difficult for blacks to change jobs. And probably most importantly, some of these laws made it possible for a black worker to be arrested on more or less trumped-up charges if he didn't cooperate with you, if he didn't do what you wanted. So that it became more and more important for a black worker to have a white patron or somebody that looked after them in order to keep them out of legal troubles.
Well, I know you've done research on the streetcars. Now, is that an example of transferring costs from one group to another?
Well, the streetcars case is very interesting. I'll give you a little bit of background to that article. What I did there was to study the origins of streetcar segregation in various cities throughout the South. And what I found was that in a number of cities, streetcar segregation was introduced in the late 19th century, and it was introduced by legislation. So what you had was a period of 10 or 15 years where people rode on the streetcars, and they rode wherever they wanted, and they sat down beside anybody they wanted to sit down beside, and so forth. And then you had legislation introduced, which required segregation, segregated seating, and blacks to the back, and so on and so forth. Now, what happened in that case was that what I suspect was happening in that case is that that costs were being transferred in part to the actual streetcar company owners. I mean, the people who were really hurt by it, in addition to blacks, whom nobody cared about at that point, but people who were hurt besides blacks were the streetcar companies themselves. So what happened was, in the late 19th century, you had blacks being disenfranchised throughout the South. And so therefore, it was easier to do things to them that you wouldn't have been able to do earlier. So you had a wave of segregation legislation, which in large measure, the streetcar companies themselves resisted. Because they said, this is going to be too expensive for us. It's going to be expensive because the black passengers will not want to ride. It's going to inconvenience them. They're not going to like it. Secondly, it's going to be costly for us to separate people. Our conductors are going to have to go around and chase people out of seats and evict them from the cars and so on and so forth. And we just don't want to be bothered. And so a number of the streetcar companies actually actively resisted enforcing the law. And I think that what was going on here is that you had, it was a situation where you had a kind of latent preference for segregation, where everybody thought, yes, it would be nice if we didn't have to sit next to black people in the streetcars, but there was no way to really get that preference enforced short of having a municipal ordinance to require the streetcar companies to segregate. And you probably couldn't have gotten those ordinances passed at all if black voters had been voters which counted. In other words, blacks were not voting at that point, and so nobody was courting their vote. The only vote that counted were whites, and so it was not a very costly thing to do to require streetcar segregation, and you made a few voters very happy, and a few voters were aggravated a little bit, and then the people who were hurt the most didn't vote. And I think that's what took place there. Now, I think what's most significant, though, about the streetcars research is that it shows that the segregation did not come about because of the private companies, that it was not in their interest to segregate, it was not in their interest to discriminate against their black passengers, and that until they were required to do so, they didn't. And you see, I think that's a very important counter to the presumptive kind of question that you raised earlier, saying, well, gee, if we didn't have laws to protect black people, look what would happen to them. The fact of the matter is, if we didn't have laws to hurt black people, I wonder what they might have been able to do. I wonder where we might be today if we hadn't had laws to hurt black people.
Voting with one's resources, then, is far more powerful than voting politically.
Well, no, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, Bob, because There are disabilities that can be imposed on you politically that can't be imposed on you any other way. And so if you don't have the vote, you know, you can be in a lot of trouble. But it is still true that being able to vote with your feet or vote with your resources, that's, of course, a very important constraint on what people can do to you. But that's why, you see, this kind of question, this is why it's so important that we look at the legal system and what we want it to do in a more systematic and careful way. If we just say, we feel sorry for black people, so we want to have a law to do this or that for black people, that's fine. The question is, can the law do that? Can the law successfully achieve the goals we set for it? And secondly, if you have a legal system that is able to do those things on behalf of one group, haven't you put yourself into a situation where your legal system is in fact able to do things against this is the very same group that you're now concerned about? You see, and that's what I think is so striking about looking at the shift between the Jim Crow era and the civil rights era. A lot of the Jim Crow powers, the powers that allowed the states and localities to impose Jim Crow laws, a lot of those powers are still being used, but now to try to help black people, you see. So the question is, would we be better off without those powers? Would it be better off if black people simply protected themselves with their resources and nobody worried about, and they didn't have to worry about their votes because vote didn't amount to anything, you see? You know, if you strip the powers of their, if you strip the state of all these powers, then it wouldn't matter very much whether you could vote or not. It wouldn't matter who was in power. It wouldn't matter, you know, all these other things. It wouldn't matter whether people hated you and so forth. That would become much less important. That's the point. Or that's at least the research question, which I think there is becoming a stronger and stronger presumption in favor of a kind of race-neutral approach to the law.
And the research, in a sense, supports the belief that if you strip government of these powers, the marketplace is an effective way to deal with the problems that government's now struggling with.
Well, I think there's certainly no question in my mind that the marketplace can do a great deal more than the common person gives it credit for. And so I think that it's not quite fair to say, well, let the market take care of it and everything will be fine. That's not quite true. But it's a lot closer to being true than what most people think. And the reason it's not quite true to say, let the market take care of it, is that the market itself is embedded in a whole set of legal and cultural institutions. And you have to address those. And that's what's so challenging about this line of research, is that you can't just say, well, let the market take care of it and you're finished with your story. That can't be the end of the story. You have to ask, what legal institutions support the market? What do we mean by a contract? What do we mean by a legal remedy and so forth? And those were the kinds of things. This is why, you see, Bob, this is why so many people get confused about the late 19th century, because they say, well, look, that was a laissez-faire time. That was laissez-faire, wasn't it? If blacks couldn't make it then, under your theory is that the market is going to help blacks. Well, if they didn't make it then, and that was the big laissez-faire time, so obviously there's something wrong with this theory. Well, what's wrong with the theory is that the market is only part of the whole social order. And what was going on around the market at that time were a series of legal disabilities being imposed and a whole set of political coalitions that were forming at that particular time that conspired against black people. So if you're asking me, should we have race-neutral law and let the market take care of it, my answer would be a qualified yes. And the qualification would be, it depends on how free the market really is. Because if you have a race-neutral law with a market which has within it, for instance, licensing requirements so that everybody has to be licensed to do any kind of occupation, then the people who are sitting on the licensing boards are going to see that only their friends get licenses, you see. So the answer, that's a sense in which the answer has to be qualified. And traditionally, those kinds of constraints have been very important in the kind of thing in the kind of discriminatory processes that we've been talking about.
There's another aspect of the civil rights question that I know you've given some attention to, and there was a lot. In fact, we still occasionally hear it that what was involved was fundamentally a state's rights question. And whether the federal government had the right to change actions that the states had taken. And yet we're also, we generally think of the states' rights argument as nothing more than a smokescreen for first slavery and then racism. Where do you stand on that? Was there a legitimate, and is there a legitimate states' rights question?
Well, Bob, this is the really difficult question of this area, and I have been giving it some thought, and I have been working on it quite a lot, because I think it's absolutely essential that advocates of the free market and believers in human liberty and human freedom go back and look at the Civil War, take a good hard look at what all the issues were surrounding the Civil War. Now, states' rights, of course, is certainly one of the issues, and slavery is certainly one of the issues. But I want to frame the question in just a little bit different way than you did, Bob. It seems to me that what's interesting about the Civil War, I mean, if you were a man from Mars and you didn't care about the United States and you didn't care about anything that was going on, it would still be interesting to observe the following combination of things happening. On the one hand, you have a war which establishes the supremacy of the federal government over the states. That's really what the Civil War did, first and foremost. It established that the federal government was supreme over the states. And at the same time, you had emancipation of black slaves. Now, those two things happened at the same time in our history. But you see, they need not have happened at the same time in our history or in anybody else's history. And so one of the things that grows out of the Civil War is an idea that the federal government is an institution which can protect individual rights. Well, now that was a very new idea in American history. I mean, some people had that idea, but certainly it would be a major mistake to believe that people prior to the Civil War, by and large, regarded the federal government as their protector or as their liberator. Quite the contrary. Most people, North and South, saw the federal government as a necessary evil, and they saw most of their rights as being protected from and flowing from their home state. So that the bills of rights of the individual states, that's what protected most of your rights, okay? The bills of rights protected you against your state doing something obnoxious to you, from your state making you have a trial without a jury and so forth, or arresting you without habeas corpus and so forth. For most people, most of the time, it was the state that protected your rights, not the federal government. So that I think that one of the things we have to do here is to really go back and look at this question of these two events being linked together that weren't linked together in anybody else's history, emancipation and federal supremacy or nationalism, and ask ourselves, which elements of nationalism are the ones that are really appropriate for us? Which powers do we really want the federal government to have? Given that we all want emancipation and we all want freedom for Black Americans and so on and so forth, okay, everybody accepts that now. We don't have to argue about that anymore. Given that, what are the elements that we got from the Civil War as far as the increased powers of the federal government? Which of those elements do we really want to live with? Which of those elements do we really need?
You've mentioned the contractarian framework of government, the contractarian approach to these problems. Give us a bit more about what that entails.
Well, contractarianism is something that a lot of people around here at the Public Choice Center talk about a great deal, and there are two ways to look at it. One is to say, well, you can think about a social contract as being a kind of justification for government. You can say, well, the only legitimate way to have a government is to say, well, people agree to the commands of the government, or people agree to be governed by this group of people or by this set of rules or whatever it might be. And the idea here is that you give your consent to a set of rules even though those particular rules might hurt you in a particular case. And so the idea would be that a government is legitimate if you would have been willing to give your consent to the rules in this kind of abstract way. Now the other way to view contractarianism, and so I would describe that as kind of a normative approach to contractarianism, or a way of justifying the state or choosing among governments or laws that could be justified and those which could not. Now, the other way to view contractarianism is to say, well, if you look at what government really is, if you just look at it as a pure matter of positive economics, and you ask yourself, well, what do you observe when you look at a government and you see how it actually operates? What you see are a group of people making trades with one another. And they make these trades at the political level as well as at the regular economic level. So you want a high tariff, I want a plant closing law, I'll vote for you, your bill, you vote for my bill, and so forth. And so you can also view the contract idea as simply a piece of positive analysis. You can use it as a tool to say, well, there are a certain set of exchanges that could take place, just like there are a certain set of market exchanges that could take place. And we know that as long as certain conditions are met, these exchanges will be mutually beneficial, and therefore you'll observe them in the political sphere. You'll observe them happening.
And in the instance of the slavery issue and or even states' rights, then we look back at the initial Constitution from the point of view of your second definition, if you would, and what we say is that the Constitution was really then a compromise. It was a series of trades between various interests. And in that case, slavery was one of the things that was accepted.
Yes.
Within that trading. Is that?
That's correct. That's correct. The Constitution has to be seen as a deal. Okay, it was a bargain, and it was a compromise. And it was a compromise of interests, and slavery was certainly one of the interests that was included. And the interest changed over time. The other interesting thing about the Constitution is I think it's important to realize that the Northwest Ordinance was part of the same deal as the Constitution. The Northwest Ordinance governed how the territories, the Northwest Ordinance, Northwest Territory, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin, how those five states, what land that became those five states, that the law that governed those that area was all settled at the same time as the Constitution was settled. And one of the things that the delegates to the Constitutional Convention were concerned about was what would be the future of slavery in various areas. And one of their questions was, where will we allow slavery in the area that we own but that we do not now inhabit? So in the Northwest Territory, they decided no slavery would ever be permitted in the Northwest Territory. But in the Southwest Territory, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, those places, slavery would be permitted. And that was all part of the constitutional log roll as well, as what we normally think of as the Constitution, the words written on the paper.
Well, using the approach that you apply, the contractarian framework, do you have any thoughts as to how we could have extricated ourselves from the slavery dilemma without going through the trauma we did?
Well, that's a very good question, and I've thought about that a great deal. I mean, the interesting thing is that slavery was abolished throughout the Western Hemisphere, and we were the only country where there was a civil war over the subject. So, of course, it's an important question to ask, why did we have a civil war? And as you know, I've been working quite a bit on the question of why we had a civil war rather than having a slave revolt or a gradual emancipation or some other thing, all the various things which took place in other places. And I think if you ask what could we have done differently, there are a lot of things we could have done differently. But the key thing that we could have done differently is that we could have quit expanding the territory of the United States. You see, because what happened was that as the United States expanded, every bit of new territory came up for grabs as far as whether it would be slave or free. And what people were worried about was whether or not this new territory, whether or not the senators associated with the new states would vote on my side or vote on your side. And so what you have there is a I think, a very difficult problem for any kind of political science model, which is that all of a sudden you're voting on who the next batch of voters are going to be. So you could imagine that that's going to be an explosive situation, because if you lose the vote, you're going to be in big trouble. You're going to lose all the future votes, right? Because if your friends don't get voted in and are not allowed to vote in the next time, but your enemies get all of their friends in, you know, you've had it. So the problem was that territory was acquired in the United States, and then every inch of territory became the subject of partisan wrangling of the kind I've just described. And originally, a lot of that partisan wrangling was not specifically over slavery. I mean, it had to do with other partisan issues, too. But that's the issue that everything finally, of course, cracked on with slavery. So that if you had acquired territory through a constitutional amendment, which there was at one time discussion of, if you'd had to have a constitutional amendment in order to acquire the territory, then there would have been you would have had to have had consensus about how you brought it in. Okay? In other words, there would have to be something for everyone if you were going to get it passed at the constitutional, if you're going to get two-thirds of the states to ratify a constitutional amendment. Now, it turns out that when Thomas Jefferson purchased Louisiana, which was, of course, the first territory that we acquired after we became independent from England, when Jefferson purchased Louisiana, he agonized over whether he had the constitutional authority to do it. And in fact, he was pretty sure that the Constitution did not empower him to acquire new territory. So he actually drafted two constitutional amendments that would give him the power to acquire it. Well, and the reason he was worried about it was exactly this point. He was worried about how are we going to bring in all this territory without upsetting the whole constitutional balance that had been put into place in 1787.
Well, you've also done some thinking about the question of secession and
uh-huh.
and how that plays in this relationship. I don't think we have time to go into that at length, but the basis on which you claim legitimacy for secession, or suggest there was that it was a lawful act, was that it was above the contract, that it could be interpreted as deriving out of natural law. Can you give us a little insight about that? What is this natural law?
Well, natural law is an approach to political philosophy that has fallen out of some disfavor at this point, which I think that's a little bit too bad myself. But the idea is that there exists some set of laws which constrain everybody. Whether you're the king or whether you're anybody else, you're constrained by natural law. Now, of course, the medieval idea was that that came from God and that the king was constrained by the law of God and the law of nature. And so therefore, even though the king was sovereign, there were certain things that it would really be wrong for him to do, that he couldn't just do anything he wanted. So the idea is that, there's quite a bit of evidence that the 19th century Americans thought this. The idea is that the Constitution was seen as an agreement among the various states and individuals and individual citizens, was seen as an agreement. And why do you keep agreements? Why do you care about agreements? Well, you keep agreements because it's right that you keep your promises. It's right that you not tell lies and so forth. And that comes out of natural law. So the only sense in which any kind of constitutional bargain or contract or anything like that could be binding would be if you believed it was wrong to renege on your word, you see. So the contract, or the sanctity of contract itself, arises out of natural law. Well, there was also a school of thought which said, well, look, secession also arises out of natural law. The law of self-defense, the law of nations, all these things arises out of natural law, and they're above the Constitution in that sense. They're prior to, because they exist prior to the Constitution. Now, if I could say one thing about secession itself, Bob, that I think is kind of important, is that prior to the Civil War, secession was an issue or a threat that was not simply brought up by Southerners. And most people don't realize this, but the abolitionists, the most radical abolitionists, for 25 years argued that the North should secede from the South. And the reason they argued that is that they believed that the Constitution required them to give support to slavery, which I think it did require them to give support to slavery. It says right in there, you have to return fugitive slaves and so on and so forth. But so the most radical abolitionists all argued that the only proper thing to do was to just secede from the Union. And the reason you would do that is so that you would not have to compromise your principles as an abolitionist by supporting the Constitution. So there were a lot of people, and mostly radical people, who argued for secession in various ways. But the important point about secession, I think, from a point of view of individual freedom, is that a constitution which allows secession, or a system, let's say, that allows secession, is going to be quite different from one which does not allow secession. So if you think about local governments, Bob, just think about the idea that if the taxes get too oppressive in your locality, you can move someplace else. Well, that's secession, see? Mm-hmm. You've withdrawn yourself from that. And so there's a limit on what the local governments can do to you.
Everybody moved to New Hampshire.
Everybody takes off, you know? And so one of the things that went on in the 19th century was that somebody would threaten to secede if they were about to have a redistributive plan that was going to be too oppressive to somebody, they threatened to secede. And so there were a lot of things that just couldn't be done because somebody would threaten to secede. And it was a fairly credible threat, not totally credible, but credible enough that you could constrain government with the threat of secession in a way that you can't without it. And that's where I think it's so tragic that our secession issue is linked to the slavery issue. Because on the one side, the secession option is one that does enhance individual freedom. I don't think there's any question about that. But at the same time, they were exercising it as a way of protecting the most vile degradation of human freedom, namely chattel slavery. And so that's why I find this area so challenging and so really vital that advocates of freedom go back and look at. Because if we don't look at it, you know, you can be sure that the leftists and so forth who want to make the market look bad, who want to make the Constitution look bad and so forth, you can be sure that they'll be back there using that for their purposes.
I want to shift back to the marketplace.
Okay.
And the discussion we had about the use of government to impose results that the marketplace is not supporting or not making happen. Can you give us an example, a contemporary example, of how this works? Is there one that springs to mind as to a situation where government has stepped in and forced action that previously the marketplace was unwilling to allow to happen?
Well, there are a lot of things that you could cite in this regard. One thing would be the whole area of comparable worth. The minimum wage law would be one example. What comparable worth is doing is attempting to require that employers pay wages that are higher than what the market would support. Now, the problem with doing that is that it makes women more expensive to hire. And when you do that, when you make women more expensive to hire, then you're going to hire fewer women. And so it's one of these ironic situations where by advocating something that's supposed to be helping women, people are ending up limiting the employment opportunities. It's going to have the consequence of limiting employment opportunities for women and probably shunting them into much more job segregated type of occupations than they otherwise would be. Same is true with something like minimum wage. You're trying to help people, you're trying to make them better off and so forth. So you're mandating a wage higher than the market would normally pay. And in the process, you're basically pricing people out of the market.
Well, you've mentioned those two. Job discrimination is another one in the civil rights sense.
Yes.
And the issue of blacks. Again, we hear all the time that these are examples of market failure. Are they?
Well, look at the concept of market failure, I think, is one that's really badly abused and misused. So I think a better way to analyze it, even if you were an advocate of it, I think would be to say, well, look, the market is not producing results that we find desirable, so we're going to intervene to try to create those results. Well, the problem with doing that is that it assumes that the government can just go in and do anything that it wants without any ill consequence or without any side effects. And the problem with doing that is that people typically don't understand why it is that they got to where they are in the first place, which is why I decided that I was going to do this historical work on segregation and discrimination in order to try to figure out how we got to where we are in the first place. So it's true that the law now requires things like quotas and affirmative action and so on and so forth. And it's true that certain people have been benefited by that. I think it would be foolish to deny that. But at the same time, I think the worst off members of the black community are not particularly being helped by that. In fact, maybe being hurt by it. Because what's happening is if you hire a black worker, it's very costly to fire them. So therefore, people tend to hire only those with the best qualifications. And it really makes it more expensive in a way. It does so many different things that it's hard to balance out exactly what it's doing. But part of what it does is makes it expensive to hire a black person that you might later fire, or any minority, or a woman even that you might later fire. So you have to be sure in the academic world, for example, you have to be very sure that you're going to hire, if you hire somebody, that you're going to be able to promote them to tenure. Otherwise, they might turn around and sue you, and that's going to be a big headache. And so, therefore, it's been very beneficial to people who have a lot of credentials and who are highly qualified, the people who would probably do okay anyhow, but the people who presumably everybody's concerned about, the people at the bottom or the people in the middle, it's not so clear what these programs have had a beneficial effect.
Just occurred to me, in doing that, you also change what has in a traditional long-term sense been an exciting kind of a new a venture for an individual who's applying for a job and an employer who's looking for someone, instead of that being a forward-looking thing in the sense of, gee, glad to have you aboard, let's go. It's almost like, well, gee, are you going to cause us any trouble? There's a real psychological change there.
Well, I think people who are candid have to say that is true, that there have been some very insidious psychological changes that have taken place. I remember when I went to look for my first job, I got a lot of interviews, a lot of offers for interviews from various universities that I would have to describe as bogus interviews. In other words, they needed to say that they had interviewed a certain number of women. And so there I was from, quite a good school and with quite good people writing letters for me and so forth. And so I got into a lot of people's doors that I wouldn't have gotten into, but they did not have the first interest in hiring a labor economist from the University of Rochester. They did not have the first interest in me. What they were interested in was checking off their box, see? Mm-hmm. And I must say, I did find that demoralizing in a lot of respects. There was one situation where I knew a university had been under serious affirmative action pressure, and I was afraid to go there, you know. I thought this would be a nightmare if I went here, because even if I did very well and was promoted and so forth, no one would ever believe it. People would just assume, oh, that's the woman who got promoted where at that school where they were having so much trouble. You know, she's an affirmative action candidate. Mm-hmm. And that's very demoralizing. That's mm-hmm. very demoralizing.
Second-class citizen.
Yeah, I'm afraid so all over again, you know. And so in that sense, for all of the agitation that there has been, it's not clear that there has been very much net progress, you see. And this is what worries me about this whole area, is that there's a lot of agitation. There are a lot of hopes being raised and a lot of aspirations. And a lot of very legitimate worries about being a second-class citizen or being treated as an inferior and being treated as somehow not worthy of being taken seriously and so forth. Those are very real concerns, but it is my belief that the law is extremely limited in the way in which it can handle those problems. And so what we've evolved to since the Civil War and since the New Deal, is we've evolved to a society that sees every problem as requiring a legal remedy. Whereas in Jacksonian America, that would be absurd to think about the law protecting you from all these kind of things. You would think about some other way of solving it. You'd think about your family. You'd think about your church. You'd think about other social institutions and organizations as being the place to work. But now we have this idea that the way to solve a problem is to pass a law, and probably a law at the federal level. And I think that's very much a Civil War heritage, quite frankly.
And in considering this question, are you saying that we ought to think about the fact that government failure?
Oh, you bet. Oh, you bet. Government fails all the time. And that's part of what the Public Choice Center is all about, of course, is trying to understand government failure, when it fails, why it fails, and so forth. And what we mean by a government failure usually is, have we been able to give people what they really want? When you have a situation where people want conflicting things, well, you won't be able to give people what they want. You know, I mean, it doesn't even make sense to ask that question, whether you've been successful at giving people what they want. So therefore, you have to rethink the whole question of what it is you want the government to do. When you say government failure, what is it that the government has failed at? Just like I recoiled a little bit when you asked about market failure, what is it the market has failed to do, right? You have to ask what the objective is before you can say whether you've failed or not.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself a feminist?
I guess I would say I consider myself a skeptical feminist, Bob.
Could you define that?
Yeah, sure. I consider myself as someone who is interested that women have equal opportunities and so forth, but I'm very, very skeptical about the sort of soft left or even hard left approach to giving women the opportunities that that they ought to have. I'm very skeptical about that.
So you're uncomfortable with what's called the women's liberation?
Yes, I would say so. I would say for what's called that, yeah, I would say that I do have some problems with that. Although I'm very grateful to be able to work in a department that's almost all men, and to be able to have a pilot's license and do all kinds of things that women aren't supposed to do.
Yeah.
That's been very important to me. And the women's movement, I think, is entitled to some of the credit for that. But I don't think the women's movement is entitled to all of the credit for that. I mean, surely, of course, some of the credit goes to me. And some of the credit goes to my parents and to where I was brought up and to the fact that I had two older brothers. And, you know, a whole series of things are involved in why a person is able to achieve certain things that are important to them.
And the point being that if we, in seeking a positive role for government, say, in these kinds of things, we should realize that most frequently that's a small role.
That's right. I would say that's right. It's a small role. I'm very worried, for example, about the idea that what we ought to do is have that it's a women's issue to have government-funded daycare or childcare. I mean, now who in their right mind wants the government in charge of taking care of all the children? I mean, you know, I think this is a nightmare.
Isn't part of the problem there that the question's being asked incorrectly? Yes. I've thought about this.
Yes.
It seems to me if you ask the question, do you want to take care of your children or do you want someone else to take care of them, that you're going to get diametrically different answers than what we're getting.
Yes. Yes, I think that's right. And also if you ask, do you want the government to be in charge of taking care of all the children? I think you would get a different answer than if you said, do we want government-funded daycare?
Yes.
You know, so yes, I do think the questions are posed in a way that presupposes the kind of answer that you're getting, sure.
Is there anything more you would add regarding the ability of the contractarian perspective to help us deal with these kinds of either real or perceived inequities?
Well, the main thing that I would add is that what the contractarian approach asks us to do is to say, what would people agree to? And ultimately, if the rule is an important one, what would everybody agree to? So that the measure of legitimacy is, would everybody consent to it? And if you have a handful of people who are holding out, then what the contractarian approach asks us to do is to ask yourself, well, why are they holding out? And aren't their complaints or concerns just as legitimate as the people who want this measure? And that if you do that, what you end up with is a government or a public sector that is only doing things that everybody wants it to do. And that is, I think, the appeal of approaching government from this kind of consent standpoint. Of course, it's not all that practical to go around and ask everybody what do you want, and you know, people sometimes won't tell you the truth and so forth. But at the same time, what the contractarian approach does allow us to do is it forces us to face the question of, do you really want to force down the throat of your neighbors something that they don't want to do? And how many things are you willing to thrust down their throat like that? I mean, you have to have a pretty good reason if you're going to do that.
Well, don't the occurrence and the constant growth of the occurrence of these kinds of intrusions by government, don't they effectively erode this initial contract? And aren't we confronting that? Isn't the United States constitutional contract, hasn't it been going downhill for 200
years? I think it's long gone, Bob. And I think that I shouldn't say I think it's long gone. I mean, we do have a constitution. It does put some constraints on what people do. But I do think that the constitution has been transformed quite dramatically from what it was when our founding fathers first established it. It was originally intended to provide individual freedom and to provide a central government with a few limited powers. But the problem is that when you have a central government with a few limited powers, how do you keep it limited to those few powers? And that, of course, is the major challenge for anybody who believes in limited government or contractarianism or anything else. The question is, how do you keep a limited government limited? And I think our constitutional experience leads us to be quite pessimistic about that.
And at this point, where we see that the limits seem to be totally off, things are going forever, people seem to be losing faith in not only government, but all aspects of society being able to meet their needs. How do we restore this? How do we pull this back together? Any $100,000 answer to that?
Well, Bob, I don't, you know, putting the genie back in the bottle is very difficult, but one of the things that has happened, I think, is that as government has come to do more and more things, the other institutions that used to do those things have kind of been weakened or have fallen by the wayside to some extent, so that you now have elderly people well able to take care of themselves on their Social Security checks. They don't need their families. They don't need their children. That institution has been weakened. There's no question about it. And that's how that used to be provided. You have the spectacle, and I think it really is a spectacle, of the Catholic Church, which provides the largest private, non-government social service network in the world, calling upon the government to take care of charity. I mean, it's just an astonishing thing. So the real problem, I think, or the worst thing, I think, about the growth of government has been that it has eroded all of the other institutions that used to support and take care of people and that people used to use to solve their own problems.